now we've come full circle and headed back to where the thriving years of mining and manufacturing began, in Crown Point. In 1893, the Crown Point Iron Company closed. Just a few years later, in the early 1900s, historian E. Barker described the abandoned steel-making furnaces at Monitor Bay.
Year by year, machinery rusted, houses lapsed into disrepair, weeds grew between the rails of the railroad and in piles of unused ore. Young trees sprang up and grew tall enough to conceal the desolation. The railroad was torn up in 1900, and finally in 1905, the furnaces were taken down.
But back in 1872, the Crown Point Iron Company was full on building a 13-mile-long, narrow-gauge railroad that connected the Lakeshore Bessemer Furnace up to Hammondville. We're headed to Monitor Bay, named after the famous USS Monitor. Some of the iron used to make this ship's hull came from this area. This is where the company built, as one reporter described, a double blast furnace of mammoth proportions, looming skyward near Hammond's Wharf. It was erected for nearly $500,000 and said to be one of the most perfect models of modern times. Alexander Holly, one of the guys responsible for bringing the Bessemer process to the U.S., provided the plans for the blast furnace at Monitor Bay, ensuring this steel-making plant's technological success. Holly, a man of great wit, set down his recipe for steel. So the recipe for making steel would rather be take great perseverance and equal portions of the knowledge of books and the knowledge of practice, mix them well with no end of money. The reporter Bixby covered the story of the new Bessemer steelmaking furnace.
A blast furnace should always, if possible, be visited at night, for everything about it then shows to the most striking advantage. And if he who comes in upon one for the first time out of the darkness of night does not experience a new sensation, then he is played out and incapable of one. The ponderous machinery, the bright streams of light, the intense heat, the strange figures of the workmen, now lighted up with a brighter than noonday blaze and then flittering about in the somber shadows of the huge walls, all make up a strange, weird scene. You always find the men about these works intelligent. They can give you any information respecting the machinery which you desire. No spruce clerks are to be seen hereabouts in a luxurious office, but men in homespun, who know every cough of the engine and every sound and jar connected with the machinery, and can tell as quickly if anything is going wrong as if it were their own stomachs. Step into the engine room, sit down for a minute, and watch the machinery.
Bixby reported 20 years before the demise of the iron industry in this region. He could not help feeling positive about the position of this region and its rosy future.
Of the future prospects of Crown Point, it would be difficult to speak in too glowing terms. The deposit of ore is apparently inexhaustible. The company owns its own transportation lines to the great markets. The face of the country along the lakeshore is level and well adapted to large manufacturing establishments, and the increase of the population will naturally follow. All these considerations point to an immense growth and a prosperous future.
In 1889, John Hammond, owner and president of the Crown Point Iron Company, died, and control of the company passed from local to non-local residents. American Steel and Wire Company purchased the property for far less than what it had once been worth. Furnaces and buildings were dismantled and repurposed, railroad tracks torn up and sold for scrap. A bittersweet epilogue to the life of the Crown Point Iron Company is found in a letter from a mine superintendent that knew Crown Point and remembered the boom. He was now at an iron operation in the Midwest.
In 1900, I was opening up some new mine for the American Steel and Wire Company at Hibbing, Minnesota. And when I got on the ground, I found 4 carloads of boilers and mining machinery from Hammondville. It seemed like meeting an old friend. I was told later that it was the last shipment over the Crown Point Railroad before the rails were taken up. I saw this machinery installed at Hammondville in 1873 and used it again in the development of the Clark Mine in 1900.
This story shows how the land, its resources, and the people adapt to change. From this spot, you can see the signs of modern industry, the tall stacks of international paper. People and towns are still negotiating this wave of change, and yet the element, iron, it is still deeply entrenched in this earth, and those water-filled mines hold promise once again, reinventing themselves. This time as part of a hydropower project. Moriah Town Supervisor Tom Scazzafava is optimistic.
Those mines, okay, once again are going to provide this community with substantial economic benefits. Right now, there is a hydro project that has been proposed. That's going to happen. The FERC permit should be coming any day. The investors are already there. This is a $300 million project that will utilize those mines once again to generate power. And they will generate enough power to, you know, the equivalent of 200,000 homes they will be able to light up. So I think we got a great future ahead of us. So the men that made those mines, those huge openings under the earth, they, you know, once again are going to be put to a use that's going to benefit their grandchildren, great-grandchildren for generations to come. So yeah, like I said, it's pretty much done full circle.
While the mines in Moriah may offer new purpose, Crown Point Supervisor Charlie Harrington is excited about an opportunity in Crown Point. According to Harrington, today's recreational use of segments of the 13-mile railroad that connected the blast furnace at what is now Monitor Bay and the iron ore mines in Hammondville provides residents and visitors a means of envisioning the history and heritage of Crown Point. The local snowmobile club has attained permission from landowners to use what was once the train line between the lake and the mines for a snowmobile trail. Harrington states, "Today, most of the railroad is in forested areas and all of the former railroad land is now in private hands. We appreciated those landowners for allowing this former railroad bed to be utilized for recreational use." That illustrious General Hammond, who overlooked his fine works back up at Hammondville, would never have imagined his empire being reduced to scrap. But maybe it would please him to hear how the town is repurposing its history. As this journey comes to a close, I picture one of the legends I've heard told about General John Hammond, that here at Monitor Bay, he brought his heroic horse Pink to admire his iron empire and relish its legacy.
"It's Truby. He actually took Pink up the freight elevator to show the horse the view, the machinery, workers, and all."
"That elevator brought the coal up that they dumped in the tall stacks to fuel the furnace. Ida, are you saying Pink went right in?"
"You know that horse followed him with Company H down south through 100 or so skirmishes or battles during the Civil War. It would be nothing to follow the general up an elevator."
"Well, I'll be. He shared everything with that horse. Might as well let him enjoy the view from that vantage point."
"I give him all the credit. The general and Pink created this great iron community together. They deserve to savor the view together."
Hammond's story, and so many others, are tucked away in these landscapes awaiting rediscovery. Though forests have taken over hamlets, furnaces have crumbled into rubble, and few miners remain to tell their stories, signs of the past and the legacy of iron's industry remain, continuing to shape our present.